Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current version of my Sunday sermon. Ayaan Hirsi Ali is a name that I had heard of but never paid much attention to, or much attention to her story. But over the last couple of weeks, some drama has arisen around her on the internet and in the larger world as a whole. She was born in Mogadishu, Somalia, in November 13, just had her birthday recently, 1969. She grew up in a strict Muslim family and at the age of 5 underwent female genital mutilation, a practice that she has since vehemently opposed. In 1992, Ayaan sought asylum in the Netherlands to escape an arranged marriage. She eventually became involved in Dutch politics and gained prominence for her outspoken criticism of Islam, particularly its treatment for women. Ayaan Hirsi Ali collaborated with filmmaker Theo van Gogh on the short film Submission, which criticized the treatment of women in Islamic societies. The film led to controversy, and tragically, van Gogh was assassinated by an Islamic extremist in 2004. Due to security concerns, Ayaan Hirsi Ali eventually moved to the United States. She continues to speak out on issues related to Islam, women's rights, and religious freedom. Those would be a lot of the ideas that I had known. What I didn't really know was how prominent she was among the new atheists, because given everything that she had seen, she was a tremendous proponent of life in Western democracies with the freedoms that women enjoy, and she had become an atheist because she very much saw religion as the problem, along with many of the new atheists. And so in her best-selling book, Infidel, whose foreword was written by Christopher Hitchens, the author of God Is Not Great. Quite recently, however, she wrote a piece. She appeared at this art conference where I was in London, and she's just written a piece on the website Unheard in which she says, "Why I am now a Christian." She was radicalized by the Muslim Brotherhood in Kenya. And as I said before, she went to the Netherlands and discovered, wow, there's a whole different world the way women can live. Women can live in freedom. They can have their own choices about who to marry and how to live. And isn't this wonderful? And she noticed very much the separation between those worlds. In an interview that she did on Unheard on their website, she noted that when she first got to the Netherlands, it was the first time she saw a Jew, and she was surprised at the sight of one because they looked like a human being, and growing up hearing all the horrible things about Jews, she thought they were some sort of monster. Now, her declaration as being a Christian has caused a lot of hubbub. It's not quite exactly Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris declaring that they have converted to Christianity, but it's fairly close. She was an awfully important person in that group, especially because she was an African woman, while all the rest are white men. Like many new atheists, she reacted against what seemed to be foolish, empty, and even evil religion. They had a sort of a vision for a life, she and many new atheists had a vision for life as it should be. And we all sort of imagine that's kind of an easy thing to think about. And we imagine that this is natural. This is just plain life, regular life outside of any sort of constraints. But is it really? Because when you think about what is natural, well, take away your clothing, take away your technology, take away everything that is you and place you in the middle of the wilderness and, well, suddenly you have a sense that you are sitting atop thousands of years of human civilization, technology, and community to give you the comfort of living inside with four walls and a roof and heating and food and a refrigerator. Natural is hardly the kind of life we'd like to lead. Now, expectations on normal are actually remarkably good for many of us who live in the developed, affluent, secure West, especially a place as affluent and stable as the United States. I'm going to read something from the book of Isaiah, chapter 65, and while you might say, yeah, that's aspirational, it might not seem very strange to you, probably nowhere near as strange as it seemed to the people who first heard it. "See, I create new heavens and a new earth. The former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in what I will create, for I will create Jerusalem to be a delight and its people a joy. I will rejoice over Jerusalem and take delight in my people. The sound of weeping and of crying will be heard in it no more. Never again will there be an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his years. I remember when I was a missionary in the Dominican Republic, I once had an adult education class filled with men and women from a particular Haitian community up in the mountains on the Dominican side of the border, and I once asked them, how many of you have lost a child before the age of 5? And nearly everyone in the room raised their hand. If you would do such a thing in Europe or in Western Europe or America, when someone actually loses a child before the age of 5, we count it as a terrible tragedy and an unusual occurrence. Never again will there be an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his years. The one who dies at 100 will be thought a mere child. The one who fails to reach 100 will be considered accursed. They will build houses and dwell in them. They will plant vineyards and eat their fruit. No longer will they build houses and others live in them, or plant and others eat. For as the days of a tree, so will the days of my people. My chosen ones will live and enjoy the work of their hands. They will not labor in vain, nor will they bear children doomed to misfortune, for they will be a people blessed by the Lord, they and their descendants with them. Before they call, I will answer. While they are still speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb will feed together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. Dust will be the serpent's food. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, says the Lord. Now, I'm sure 2,500 years ago, that sounded a lot more aspirational than it sounds today. With us today, even if some people around the world don't seem to be enjoying this, we get upset and think we must protest and do something about it. But is this really the world we're living in? You might say, well, but we do sort of read that prophecy from Isaiah and think, well, that's normal. That's how the world should be. But have you ever actually really known such a world? Even in beautiful, secure, affluent Sacramento, California, there are the homeless who live on the street and wrestle with mental illness or substance abuse. There are many who struggle in one state or another, depression, alcoholism, illness, and those words of Isaiah still seem a little ways away. Compared to people even living 100 years ago, those metrics look closer today than they looked before. But on other metrics, depression, loneliness, isolation, children struggling, things look further away. It's funny how there's not really sort of a straight line to that vision. Something is wrong with the world. Far earlier in the book of Isaiah is one of my favorite passages, and it's a parable, a song, and it's a song about God's people, God's project, God's land. I will sing for the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. Then he looked for a good crop of grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now, this is obviously the story of Israel. God created Israel to be a light unto the nations, to be a priesthood among the peoples of the earth, to be an example of what would happen if a people would actually live the way the God of creation wanted them to live. He would be their God, and he would live in their midst, and they would be a people that all the world would see and want to live like and want to live with. But something happened. Last week, we looked at the book of Hosea. The book of Hosea consists of narrative about a prophet and sayings attributed to him. Hosea began his career in the final days of Jeroboam II, we talked about this a little bit last week, whose long reign, 788 to 747 BC, capped a century of political stability and economic prosperity in the northern kingdom of Israel under the dynasty founded by Jehu in 842 BC. Jeroboam died in 747, 2 years before Tiglath-Pileser III came to power in Assyria and initiated a program of imperial expansion. And last week we looked at the wall hangings from his palace that that was unearthed in the 19th century. Israel had enjoyed a long period of prosperity and security, but if you remember last week's sermon, God wasn't terribly impressed by what they had done with everything that he had given them. John Wesley made this observation about religion: "I fear wherever riches increased, the essence of religion has decreased in the same proportion. Therefore, I do not see how it is possible in the nature of things for any revival of religion to continue long. For religion must necessarily produce both industry and frugality, and these cannot produce but produce riches. As riches increase, so will pride, anger, and love of the world in all of its branches." In the book of Deuteronomy, the Lord gives a covenant, and it says, if you obey my covenant, you will be blessed. If you disobey my covenant, you will be cursed. And if you look at the kinds of things that are listed in Deuteronomy 28 about the blessings, they don't look that different from Isaiah 65. If you fully obey the Lord your God and carefully follow all of his commands I give you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. All these blessings will come on you and accompany you if you obey the Lord your God. You will be blessed in the city and blessed in the country. The fruit of your womb will be blessed, and the crops of your land and the young of your livestock, the calves of your herd and the lambs of your flock. Your basket and your kneading trough will be blessed. You will be blessed when you come in and blessed when you go out. The Lord will grant that the enemies who rise against you will be defeated before you. They will come at you from one direction but flee from you in seven. The Lord will send a blessing on your barns and on everything you put your hand to. The Lord your God will bless you in the land he is giving you. And it goes on and on and on from there. But of course, that's not what happened. What happened with this vineyard? Well, we saw some of it with Hosea. The story continues. "Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I will tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. He looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for righteousness, but heard cries of distress." Last week, we looked at the northern kingdom of Israel. Isaiah is focusing on the southern kingdom of Judah and says, same verse, same as the first. But these are God's chosen people. Andrew Clavin's brother once told Andrew Clavin, "The reason the Jews are God's chosen people is because no one would volunteer." Why? Others have quipped, "Why doesn't he choose someone else?" Andrew Clavin made a very interesting observation about the role of Israel with respect to humanity. "They are the theater in which God plays out his relationship with humankind. The Bible is a microcosm of the far larger story." At our 9:30 Sunday school class, we look at the relationship of the Jews to the whole world as Paul writes to the Romans. He goes on. God says to his people, "You cannot do what others are doing. Yes, everyone else is sacrificing their child to the gods, not so amongst you. Yes, everybody else is worshiping statues and idols and doing all of this, trying to manipulate the gods in order to get ahead in life. Not so amongst you. You are to be devoted to me in the fashion of love, not manipulation." All through the history of the Bible, Clavin says, Israel fights against God. "Please let us do what the nations do. Let us sacrifice our children. Let us set up statues and worship them. Let us manipulate you and get you to give us what we want." Even though again and again, God said, "I would love to give you even more than what you can expect. But why do you keep fighting me? Why do you keep wrestling me? Why do you keep running away from me?" But God won't let them go. We saw that last week with Hosea. This famous passage in Isaiah, the Song of the Vineyard, is a song about Israel, but it's also a song about all of us. all over the world. The world is his vineyard, and he looked for good grapes, but saw bloodshed and cries of distress. But as we saw last week with Hosea, God doesn't give up. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From its roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears. But with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. After Jesus was crucified, died, arose, and ascended to heaven, Christians began to read passages like this and say, that was Jesus. Jesus is the answer. Jesus fulfills what Israel failed to do. Jesus inaugurates and initiates and points to what Isaiah was looking for. Jesus is changing our imagination of life. The wolf will live with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and the little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear, their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the cobra's den, and the young child will put his hand in the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. We're not there yet. Ian Hersey Ali wrote that piece in Unheard, and a lot of people heard it and thought, well, she's always been about politics. This is surely about politics. But then in that interview, she was quite a bit more disclosing about her personal life. She begins by saying, well, these are just some personal things. I don't think it'll help anybody. Oh, no. It is, in fact, the heart of the matter, because if you adopt a religion just because you think it will help you in politics, nobody recognizes that or respects that. It's got to be personal to be powerful. You see, we are changed by the desert. We are changed by the walls coming down in the vineyard. And whether it's civilizational or personal, it sends us looking for a better God than ourselves. I went through a period of crisis, a very personal crisis of fear, anxiety, depression. I went to the best therapist money can buy. I think they gave me an explanation of some of the things that I was struggling with, but I continued to have this big spiritual hole or need. I tried to self-medicate. I tried to sedate myself. I drank enough alcohol to sterilize a hospital. Nothing helped. I continued to read books on psychiatry and the brain, and none of that helped. All of that explained a small piece of the puzzle, but there was still something I was missing. And then I think it was one therapist who said to me earlier this year, I think, Ian, you're spiritually bankrupt. And at that point, I was in a place where I had sort of given up hope. I was in a place of darkness, and I thought, well, what the hell? I'm going to open myself to that and see what you're talking about. And we started talking about faith and belief in God, and I explained to her that the God I grew up with was a horror show. He created you to punish you and to frighten you, and as a girl and as a woman, you're just a piece of trash. And so I explained to her why I didn't believe in God. And more than that, why I actually hated God. And then she asked me to design my own God, and she said, if you had the power to make your own God, what would you do? Now right away, sort of, we hear that and we think, well, that's, isn't that what Freud sort of said we do? And isn't that what preachers are complaining we do, that God made us in his image and we return the favor? But then she began to notice something. And as I was going on, I thought, that is actually a description of Jesus Christ and Christianity at its best. And so instead of inventing yet another new God, I started diving into that story. Now, she's honest. And so far, I like this story as I explore it. And the more I look at it, the more I don't want to say I'm fulfilled, but I no longer have this need, this void. I feel like I'm going somewhere. There are standards that I have to live by that are quite high, and that's daunting. But there are standards that I'd rather aspire to, even if I fail, rather than nothing. A lot is built into our culture. A lot is built into this world that we didn't realize. And so when she began actually thinking about the life she'd always wanted, the kind of God that fit into that picture was the Christian God and Jesus Christ. Now, we are not there yet. Christians sometimes fudge their stories to try to make the sale. I don't think she's doing that at all. Don't bear false witness, even for a good cause. Tell people how you really are and what you really think. The truth is usually the best policy. We are in the drama, We are in the drama, knowing we sometimes need to enter the desert. Well, maybe if I can read my own sentences, that would help. We are in the drama, knowing we sometimes need to enter the desert. All of these words of Isaiah, they ring true, but some of them are still out ahead and out of touch, and we can't quite reach them. But we actually have hope and a promise. The branch has come, the stump has sprouted, and he calls us by name. He has conquered death. We follow him until he comes. The promises of a new heaven and a new earth are ours to hold on to. We might be tasting some of them now. There are other problems that we see around us as well. But we believe he will raise us just as God raised him, and we will see his face. Amen.